Welcome back to the National Defense. It's Randy Miller, and this next segment is going to be a little weird, kind of a little different situation for us, because the guy that I'm going to interview is an international spy. I mean, he really is, and was in Afghanistan, was in Iraq. So we had to take some special considerations. I could not be in the same room with him. I do not know his location. I could not be on the same Zoom call with him. So I'm going to sound like I'm kind of sequestered somewhere. And I'm going to let him tell his stories. But that's how we had to do that. If you're listening and you go, why did Randy sounds like he's in a box? I'm not in a box. I'm in a secluded situation, and we're going to refer to this man only as Pete Turner, because that's his name. That's all we can tell you. Enjoy.
He's got quite the story, Pete Turner. He spent several years as a spy. Counterintelligence spy for the U.S. Army, traveling to countries including Afghanistan, Bosnia, Egypt, Germany, Iraq, and he's now using his extensive knowledge and experience in geopolitics, tactical espionage, and U.S. travel to provide compelling evidence outside the typical media landscapes, which brings us to his current project, a nonprofit organization called the International Institute for Nonproliferation Studies. And he joins us here in the National Defense. Pete, how you doing?
I'm good. You know, the first thing I did when I started that effort was I took that old name and I said, let's just call this thing the Ground Truth Center, the GTC.
There you go. It's a lot easier, a lot better. Yeah.
I mean, look, it's a legacy organization that dealt with nuclear nonproliferation. We thought, yeah, that's kind of old-timey. And then it turned out with the world kind of getting crazy, and all of a sudden was sort of relevant. But, you know, where we focus is at the ground truth level, because quite often in the modern conflict space, it's just so hard to accurately nail down the foreign policy stuff that we're trying to do. You know, our priorities and our initiatives are out of whack. And it's not really anybody's fault. You're taking a stab at a big guess at an outcome. And so you're like, we'd like things to be better here. And if you don't have the people that have been shot at that have to make the relationships, that have to go day to day out and make it happen, you don't know what to do. And so, hey, here's Pete. He knows these people. He's done this stuff. And so that's where the Ground Truth Center was born.
I mean, you know, nobody has that kind of experience, and nobody's talking to the same people that you're talking to, that's for sure.
That's right.
But I want to get into some of these topics here. The Taliban actually requested a meeting with you by name.
Yeah. Yeah, we were, my buddy Rich and I were having a lot of success in this valley. So we were in a district, which was like a county, and we were having, it's way off of the main route. And so we were having a lot of impact in terms of getting farmers to show up and to pay attention to the government, because that's the goal, right? Is to make the Afghan government exist and be relevant. And so they got the governor and they said, hey, who are these guys, Pete and Rich? We want to have a meeting with them. And so call them out and have them come meet us at this farmer's house. And so, you know, and this is like what happens. And so the governor's like, hey, Pete and Rich, and this is all normal. We go see the governor all the time. I want you to go down to, we'll say, Bob's house. Bob's house is just a little past the government center, you know, totally normal for us to go out and go meet someone somewhere. And so we go to Bob's house and there's a bunch of farmers there. And so we don't think anything of it. We're just doing the standard thing and just doing what we always do and have a meeting. And then we go home. And then a couple of days later, the governor calls us back and he's like, hey, I just want to let you guys know, the other day when we were at Bob's house, just to be clear, Bob is not the guy's name. When we went to Bob's house, Taliban called that meeting. They were in the room. And the good news is they liked you guys. They thought you were respectful and scholarly. And so you guys have the Taliban stamp of approval. And we're like, well, that makes sense. Because we're good dudes.
Wow. Well, okay. But now, so you're a spy.
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't you have known already that those were Taliban?
You know, we're in Taliban country, right? Mullah Omar lived within a mile of all the main camps in that state that we had all of our stuff at. So these guys, and they all know that. So these guys all look like each other. And so, no, there's no way sure. for me to reliably know that. And they certainly don't wear a patch. Not like if they're driving around.
Right.
Yeah. You might know.
Sure. That, no.
But we don't know that. Yeah. And the thing is that even though I'm a spy and I'm doing my stuff, I never lie about that. And so I don't, here's the worst way. Randy, it's not going to surprise you. The worst way to find out where the bombs are is to say, where are the bombs? So I never asked that question.
Right. Yeah. Well, how did you get started in your career in counterintelligence?
You know, I had no intention of joining the military, and I just could not find a job out of college. It was a bad time to find jobs, one of those downturns in the economy in the early 90s. And so one day I was just pushing carts in the rain at Costco, you know, just kind of like, I graduated. What am I going to do? And me and this other dude in the same spot, he had a better degree than I had. And he's like, I think I might go become a spy in the Army. And I'm like, I'd never thought about that. Huh? And so I was pushing carts and I'm like, I've got to do something. And so I went from never considering it to being in the Army and then taking counterintelligence as the job in 30 days. And so I'm just like, I've got to do something. It's time to choose. And so I tested really well. I'm a pretty intelligent guy. And my recruiter was great. He didn't lie to me at all. He's like, I've never put anybody in this job. It's got a high number. Must be good. You should do it. And so I said, all right, let's do it. And it worked out. It really suited my skill set too.
Well, I mean, I think you have to have a certain kind of personality to be successful as a spy, though, right? I mean, you've got to have that mentality. You certainly have to be very smart, but you kind of have that personality to kind of, pivot at any time during any mission, right?
Yeah. There's a lot of truth to that. In particular, in my job, there's probably 140 different disciplines within my job. Like, you might be a guy who runs lie detectors, totally different dude than me. You might be a guy that focuses on electronic counterintelligence. You might be a guy that loves doing surveillance. And I'm trained in some of this stuff, but what I am good at is building networks and meeting people and going to hard places. I'm a physical dude. I'm an athlete. And so when I get with infantry guys, I can hang with them. That's not common in counterintelligence. Right. Most of these guys are, I'm going to be fair. A lot of these guys are soft, right? And they want to plan stuff. They want to do puzzles. I can do puzzles, but if you say, hey, we're all going to get together and we're going to get drunk and get in a big fight and punch each other in the mouth, I'm down for that. And so when I get with an infantry unit, you know, I can hang with those guys and I'm not afraid. And so that makes me good at tactical collection, because when it's hard, I have a lot of my friends who would never want to go out on the patrols I go out on. Like, oh, is there going to be shooting?
Oh, I'll bet.
Cool, let's go. Yeah. I have done source meetings in the middle of gunfights. That's not normal. So I was able to do that, right? And it's not me bragging. I'm just saying that there's very specific, all of our careers are very siloed. And my, like, there's nobody who's done what I've done at my level, but my peer can say the exact same thing. And so we're all very peaky in our skill sets and how we got there. So I figured out what my thing was, and I was able to stay in my area long enough to become, you know, a grandmaster at tactical collection.
That's incredible. We're talking to Pete Turner here in the National Defense, several years as a counterintelligence spy for the Army. And now you talked about, you know, building these networks, and I assume you mean networks of the enemy, number one, and as well as allies. And so there had to be points in some of these where somebody's not happy with what Pete's doing, and that had to be a little hairy at times, right?
This is a funny thing, 100% true. And that place normally is with the Americans on the American camps. That is where I'm the most imperiled, honestly, until I learned how to, because I don't belong to a unit usually. So I'll join a unit or they will join the area where I'm at. And if I don't navigate, and until I learned how to work with the staff, and until I learned how to speak commander, and until I learned how to make sure the sergeant major knew who I was and how I could help him, I would get kicked off camps all of the time. I would get denied access to patrols. They wouldn't take me out. So I had to learn how to work within the American system Otherwise, I couldn't balance that side of the equation. I got kicked off camps. I got kicked out of theater all the time because I have a lot of bad news. Like when things aren't working. So I've got two basic jobs from two different perspectives, right? My job is to help the commander win more and lose less, and then help the enemy lose more and win less, right? And so the easiest, fastest deliverable I can give is help the commander realize where he's losing. And in the modern fight, most of the time, it's not killing the enemy. It's like, hey, here's how you stop losing. You're not building governance. You're not, no one's calling the police that you're training. How do we improve that capability? How do you stop losing? And people don't like to be told that they suck. And a lot of what I do revolves around that because the commander's desperate to learn. Like, what do you mean we're doing all this training and no one sees it? No one believes it. And I'm like, I don't know, man. But I'm just telling you, no one around here is ever going to call the cops. You know, like we work on rule of law all the time and no one's ever in court, ever. And that matters to a commander. Staff hates that.
Well, and Pete, just to kind of underscore that, I think that's a good lesson from the exit from Afghanistan. All of these so-called police and military that we trained, what happened? They're done. I mean, nobody's sticking around to stand up for Afghanistan.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I'm going to be a little bit hard, but I'm going to be accurate here. The only army I know of that sent out a rider under the flag of truce and negotiated a stacking of arms and departure from theater is us. We are the only one that did that. Taliban didn't do it. Al-Qaeda didn't do it. Mm-hmm. They all stayed, right? We said, hey, we want to negotiate peace. We are going to leave. We're going to leave all of our gear. We're just going to march out. That's the only one that did that. So think about that. You know, that is that. So it's really hard to win militarily in these conflicts, right? And so we want to win militarily, but most commanders that I encountered, even though it's the first line item in their mission statement, they weren't able to encircle. They weren't able to close with and destroy. Mm-hmm. They didn't grab any guidons from anybody. And so how do you win? Well, it's the other stuff that we talk about, and it's really hard to do that.
Well, yeah, you know, and changing a culture, I mean, that takes a few hundred years, right?
Yeah, yeah. If you can even do it.
It's kind of like the same thing that's happening in Ukraine. You know, it's funny to me, and I will readily admit that I don't understand any of it, but the fact that, you know, you send weapons, you send people into an area where you really don't know what's going on, and try to acclimate. That's a tough deal.
Yeah. This goes back to the Ground Truth Center and what we try to do. You talk about creating a culture. Is it easier to work within a culture to accomplish your goal, or is it easier to create a culture somewhere else where it's foreign to you? You know, and we always try to create something. It's like, hey, they have rule of law. They know how to farm. They know, you know, what, like we would, this will sound preposterous, but it's true. We would go to Afghan villages and teach Afghan women about having a period as if the period didn't exist.
I believe that.
Yeah. Like they didn't have periods before. Like they were like, well, I don't know what to do about these menses. Like I promise they had a system for this, you know?
Yeah.
And they weren't like, oh, too stupid to know. No, they dealt with it. And so we couldn't comprehend that. And so we would ignore these things and come in and engage someone else's women, which is completely inappropriate in their culture.
Right.
Completely inappropriate. Right. And we would have no specific training or license to do this. And so, look, I'm all about trying to figure out how to lift up people and everything else, but it's very specific professional work. We don't treat it like that. And I'm using women as an example because we're desperate to get it right, but we're not desperate to do the work.
Yeah, that's fascinating. We're talking to Pete Turner here in the National Defense. And, you know, you have to be in those kind of situations. And when you said that, we're too stupid to know, that has to be the scariest thing for you to get to. You're talking to somebody and they act like they don't know anything. That's when you've got to be fearful, right?
Yeah, Yeah. Oh my gosh. You would see a lot of this where we would come in with all of the answers, but never. It's one of the sayings that I developed, and these are people that are highly educated. And let me just say this up front. I've made all the mistakes too. You know, we've read all the books, we've got all the degrees, we have the best intentions, but then we can't learn a thing when we get there. And so the saying is this, like, you cannot presume to improve the condition of something you refuse to understand the condition of. Like, we would just come in and we would never go, what is going on here? Like, we come in, we're like, all right, we're going to fix your farming. What? So I asked this ag team, the ag teams are terrible. So you come in, I see this major, and he's like, hey, we're going to improve the plot of the farmer. Okay, great. What is the market chain for these farmers? Well, I don't know. Well, then why are you messing with it? He's like, well, that's my job. Okay. Well, so, and again, doesn't sound like spy work, but now I'm going to go back to the commander. I'm going to be like, the ag team has no idea what the market chain is. And so now the commander goes, hold on, stop. Why are we messing with the market chain? And then the ag boss has to go, who the hell told you we don't know the market chain? And he's going to go, it's Pete. And then
throw him out of here.
Right.
Get him out of here.
And the commander's like, no, Colonel, I'm the boss. You tell me what's the market chain. Well, sir. Okay. All right. Pete gets a point. I want Pete back out there with you guys.
I can see now why Pete, you know, you're asked to leave a lot. That, I mean, you're talking about, uh-huh. You know, making somebody look less than intelligent there. Yeah. And a lot of those, Colonel tried
to kick me out of theater later on. And here's the thing, it's my boss. Yeah. My boss got an ass chewing. But they were like, oh, we want to leave theater. That Colonel really had it out for me, right? And so my boss was like, okay, I'll put him on the next thing smoking. You show me in this report the one place where Pete is wrong. And the deputy goes, damn it. And he walked away because I wasn't wrong. I might have been a little bit direct against an OC.
Yeah,
I'm just Pete, but my boss.
You're saving time. Take
it. Yeah, but I wasn't wrong.
You're saving time, yeah. And Pete, in all of your years in your role in counterintelligence, tell me the most dangerous situation. I mean, I know you can't talk about the details, but
yeah.
Can you think of one that is just. You know, maybe you had the cyanide pill ready.
Yeah. You know what? Okay. I will tell you one. And it is, there's a lot of crazy ones. But there's one that comes to mind. And it's actually in a book that's really good. It's a book called Codename Johnny Walker. So there was an Iraqi interpreter that belonged to the SEALs. And because of my relationships that I happen to have with the SEALs, somehow that happened. But Johnny Walker became our interpreter for a while. And so we had this sort of shadow tasking. Can you help us figure out some things? And so we ended up in this car going north up into Kurdistan and running some checkpoint operations among our other tasks. And at the time, checkpoints were questionable. Were they legit? Were they not legit? Were the legit ones also in their own right illegitimate? And so we got hit by this checkpoint. It looked like it was probably Iraqi army. And our interpreter is this very famous interpreter who's now an American citizen. And he's like, hey, we have to pull off here. And at the time, these checkpoints, people often end up with their heads cut off. So this is a very tense moment. Mm-hmm. So we pull off the road and I'm in the passenger seat. Our interpreter is the driver. And then behind me is my partner. And we're fully armed, but no, you know, we're being stealthy. So we're in this car, no body armor, any of that kind of stuff. And so I have my weapon off a safe. This is like a submachine gun, like an MP3 kind of weapon. And my partner's behind me, directly behind me, and I'm hoping he's not going to shoot me. So in front of us, as you can imagine, in the front windshield is the Iraqi army people from this camp. Now, the car is running. And for any of you who know this, there's a thing called a dead driver drill. So I know how to operate this vehicle from the passenger seats. So I'm prepared to shoot rounds, and then I'm going to drive this thing from the passenger seat to get out of there. And I hope that we don't kill the interpreter. But if he dies, then that's going to be the cost of us getting out of there alive. So my weapon's off safe. I've pulled the slack in off the trigger. And while our Johnny Walker, our interpreter, while he is talking, and you got to understand, when Iraqis talk, It's very emphatic. You don't know if it's going great or bad. He has a great mouthpiece.
Right.
He's got a great mouthpiece, so I'm trusting that it's working. But we are prepared to kill everybody in front of us and hopefully get past the next part of the checkpoint. Because remember, we're off the road by about 150 yards. And so we didn't know for a good 30 seconds if this was going to go horrible. And again, who knows if we even survived the first engagement. And it all worked out. It all worked out. Johnny's mouthpiece came through. We let off the triggers, took a deep breath. Johnny got back in, and he's like, all is good. Let's go. We have drinks.
And that's only one. That's only one story.
Oh, my gosh. There's so many more. Yeah. But that was intense because I'm like, have I made the mistake of my life? I didn't know.
Right.
Yeah. But right. But that's
something. And I feel like, you know, just from people we've had on the program, I feel like there was a lot of that over there. Just that unknown, you know, you just don't know which way it's going to go.
Yeah. On any given day. And you got to realize in my job, and I'm very open about what I do, I have to trust. I have to rely on trust because I cannot get into gunfights. If I get into a gunfight, I no longer can work in that area. Because now I'm burned forever there, right? I've got to basically leave that area, probably the theater, because, you know, now I'm the butcher of Kirkuk or whatever, right?
Right.
Because I can't get into that gunfight. And if I get caught, well, it's over. I mean, it's terrible, right? So my job is extremely dangerous and high risk because you don't usually run around and get into gunfights if you're a spy. It just doesn't work like that in my particular discipline.
Yeah, spies really don't want to be noticed.
Right. Now, I can be open about what I'm doing, but I have to work with trust. Once I violate that trust, once I become this violent person, everything, no one's ever going to trust me again, right? And so my trust has been broken, right?
Now, how long did you do that for?
You know, off and on, I was in with and for the military. I was in three times, sworn in, you know, and then I did some work on the contract side, you know, for a number of years. But all in, like, I would say about 18 years with about 70 months in conflict zones, you know, in various roles. But almost always with direct access outside the wire, which is, you know, off of the American camps. So I'm either day-to-day working either off the camp or working directly with the Americans, you know, bouncing back and forth between the two worlds, or working in support of people who were going off the camps every day. So a lot of
time. Were you reporting to someone? Did you ever have to report to someone?
Always.
Or
yeah, always.
Were you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but for most of the time, I ran my own operations, right? And so I could, because I was, once I developed my own system, I didn't need to be led. I just needed to be protected.
Sure.
So I would work for the commander. And I had a whole thing I would say to the commander, like, oh, look, you just need to leave me alone. I need access, and then I need your protection. And if you give me those things, other than you correcting me when I'm wrong, because I'm going to tell you what I see, and you're going to have to fine tune me. You know, you're just going to want more of me, and that's it, not less. And so they were great about that. And I didn't need to be directed in terms of like, Pete, we need you to go outside.
Right.
Like, because again, you know, I'm this dude that needs to be out in the space to work, and you didn't have to tell me to go to work.
I mean, that sounds exactly like my experience in morning radio. I don't want to be directed.
Yeah.
Let me do my thing.
Well, honestly,
if I do something wrong, I still don't want to know.
Our jobs do overlap. I mean, my degree, wait for it. My degree, undergrad, it's in TV radio, right?
So, is that right?
It's 100% true. And my job, in a lot of ways, is a news reporter. You put me in that Ford Pinto with my remote kit, and I'll be, hey, calling in Pete. Where are you? Oh, I'm at the site of the accident. You know, or I have my sources in the field. Hey, what's going on? It's totally the same job.
That's pretty good. Yeah. And your sources have to be there. I mean, you've got to develop those sources. Yeah. It would be just like a sports reporter at the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
I mean, you get one or two guys to tell you the dirt.
Yeah.
And you rely on those guys every time.
And I cannot reveal my source, right?
Yeah, right.
I'll go to jail before I reveal my source, right? Same thing. Same exact thing. It's 100%.
Have you ever had that discussion about we have to know your source and you protect that source?
Yeah, people always try to
switch. Maybe to the nth degree.
Yeah. No, and the thing is, it's always people that don't realize. And so they say, well, who's your source? And I'm like, I laugh at them, you know, or they'll say, wait a second, you gave money to this person? And I'm like, yeah, I gave them money. And like, I'll tell you, that Johnny guy, right? He came up to me one day. It's 100% true. He came up to you one day and he's like, because it's kind of like the mob, right? So he comes up to me when we first had got him and everything. The first thing I did is like, when was the last time you got a raise, Johnny? Is he working with the SEALs, right? Because the SEALs don't understand how to run human sources. And he's an interpreter, but he also was a source. And so he's like, raise. I'm like, how much are you getting paid? He's like, I'm getting paid $300 a month. And I'm like, and you're working with the SEALs? All right, hold on. Let's go get you a raise right now. So I walk him over to the company that hires these guys. I'm like, hey, I need to double Johnny's pay right now. And they're like, oh, yeah, here, fill this form out. And so we got him a raise. And I'm like, now you make $600 a month. And we're going to get you a raise again as soon as we can. So I just got him a raise. And he's like, holy, why did you do that? And I'm like, because I'm going to work the hell out of you. And what you're doing is extremely dangerous.
Yeah.
And I promise we can afford it. And so, and I'm like, do not come to camp unless we communicate with you and I need you. Otherwise, I want you to be safe because it's extremely dangerous to come to this camp. Again, people are getting their heads cut off when they work with us. So he comes to me one day and he's like, oh, Peter, I have to exact revenge. They killed my cousin. And I'm like, cool. What do you need from me? He's like, I need money to buy a gun to kill people. And I'm like, here you go. And I peeled off a couple $100, gave him what he needed, and he went out and he killed people. Because again, this is war. This is not normal work for San Diego. This is normal
work for Missouri. Right.
But that is that world, right? And so when you look at your sources and the people he has to go encounter and the things he has to do, I have to enable that because again, I am a spy. I am not someone who's, you know, this is a different thing. But it is akin to being a news reporter. It's like, hey, you're a junkie. You need to survive. Have you eaten?
Right.
Do you need a fix? All right. Well, this is how you live. Here's your money. Just keep the information coming. Right. So it is very, very similar. And so when someone's like, how are you getting all this information? That is none of your business. You give this junkie money. Of course I gave them money. They have to eat. They have to survive, you know?
Right.
And so it's the same kind of
thing. They have to trust me.
They've got to trust me. Yeah. Where do you want them to go for this? You want them to go rob somebody? Because I'd rather, I just give
them money. I want to ask you about this, the murder of a State Department diplomat, Ann Smedjinhof, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
For
yeah,
delivering books to Afghan kids. What is that about?
It's terrible. It's terrible. So my buddy Rich and I, again, we had built up a lot of credit with the people of Afghanistan in this region that we were in. The Taliban had signed up on our operations, right? And so I remember, the people in the region talk about you, even though you don't realize it. This is the thing that I learned, and it seems obvious, but the more important you get, the more they are also going, you know, oh, yeah, Pete and Rich, or just Pete, or just Rich. So one of my favorite things to hear from the Americans is when the intelligence people come up and go, Pete, oh, my God, they know who you are. They're targeting you. And I always use Pete because I want to hear this message. They go, the Taliban have said they've targeted you. They want to kill Pete. And I'm like, yes, that means you're in the game. You're on the field. You are causing them problems, right? And so these two things can be simultaneous. I can be licensed to work and I can be a target. It means you're on the field. So we have been asked to figure out about education in the region. And this is the Army asking us to do this. And we were doing it. We brought in Afghan elders. We brought in all these people. And we were slowly, methodically working our way through all the meetings required to understand the region and how the government wanted to run their education program. And so, long story short, took a long time to do this. But the briefing to us was the Ministry of Education would handle education. They wanted the Americans' help, but under no circumstances would we bring books to the Ministry of Education. This is from the elders, and key point, a religious man was in the room. They're all nodding their heads. And the elders said, you will never bring books to the Ministry of Education. He will come to you to grab these books. That is how this will work. And they're like, also important, you will never, ever, ever deliver books directly to children. That is not your job. That is the Ministry of Education's job. And again, education, religion. Religion is also code for Taliban, right?
Right.
So they gave us a contract and they said, don't do this. We want your help. We want to educate. And the Ministry of Education is like, I want your help. I want to help to understand how to execute these programs. I want to understand how to measure them if they're working. Fast forward a year later, State Department brings people in from the outside and they under a known risk of like, hey, there's an operation going on. And they had put out word that they were going to deliver books to kids. They got themselves blown up, and Anne was one of the people on this mission, and she had happened to meet John Kerry a couple weeks before. So they went off the camp. They let it be known that they're going to deliver books to kids in spite of this report that everybody had. It's not Anne's fault. But the State Department was more interested in a photo op than getting something right. Wow. They ignored this information. They ignored the instructions from the Taliban, from the government, from the elders. They ignored it. And it costs people their lives. That's one of the things that, like, when we go out and get this stuff wrong, that sits with Rich and I. We own that death because we.
You set this up basically under their guidelines, and it was working, right?
It would have worked, And the thing is there are very few people in the world that could have pulled that bit of information off, right? It was seasoned people to do that. And then they chose to ignore it. They just didn't do it. They said, oh, those dudes are crazy, you know, but we had license from the Taliban to go out and operate. We had license from the army to go out and operate. And the State Department chose to ignore it. That's the definition of folly, you know, and people died because of it.
Right.
And so when John Kerry gets up and he gives his eulogy of Anne, because he had met her a couple of weeks before, he talks about the arrogance of telling people, you know, about things and how they're supposed to learn. And like, if you read it with that context and know what the State Department had done to build this photo op, you can now read that eulogy and you realize who the real bad person was. And it was the State Department because they chose to ignore the very government they're trying to empower. They had undermined.
Pete, man, we could talk to you for hours. I mean, I'd love to have you back on. Just fascinating stories, fascinating career. Where can people find out more about you and what you're doing with your organization?
You can always email me, pete@breakitdownshow.com. If you can go to the groundtruthcenter.org, that's the website, or you can just email me, P.A. Turner on all social media, mostly on X. But you can, you can do that. I'm pretty easy to find. Just type in Pete A. Turner and you can find some kind of funnel to me. And I'm glad to talk to people.
It seems weird to me. A spy is pretty easy to find.
Well, that's my job, right? Like, you can't be informed.
No, I do. I understand that now. Did I happen to see a website with you, featuring you, that said Still Token with Pete Turner?
No, I don't. Maybe I was on somebody's show or something. Yeah, I'm not
like a Cheech and Chong deal. And
oh, I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. No, I'm not a Still Token kind of guy. But maybe I was on someone's show with that. I don't know.
I think maybe that was probably it.
Yeah.
Hey man, you're a blast, Pete. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me on your show. Good.
Absolutely. Love to have you back sometime.
Anytime.
Stay safe.
Please.
We'll be right back here in the National Defense.